to larger territorial flows.
Hey, listeners, to listen to the full show of this, go to YouTube for the Schumacher Center for New Economics. And the title is We Can't Get There From Here, Carbon, Climate, and the Call to Wonder. To check out the extended recording of this show or to explore our other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been EcoJustice Radio and our show, The Carbon Conundrum, Rethinking Our Relationship with Nature. Thank you to Bayo Okomolafe, Paul Hawken, and the Schumacher Center for New Economics. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at EcoJustice Radio, SoCal350, and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you've heard, if you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to EcoJustice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, executive producer, myself, Jack Eit, producer and co-host, Jessica Aldridge, co-host, Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Tuesday, February 11th at 5:30 p.m. This will be a hybrid meeting. It will be held at the station, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if you need.
Hi, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and this is Life Stamps, stories from here and there. I'm Joseph.
I am Tyson.
Join us every other Thursday at 10 a.m. as we discuss exciting destinations around the world. But not always from personal experience, but never without cultural awareness and a passion for travel. Life Stamps, stories from here and there. This is Joseph.
I'm Tyson.
And today we are talking about absinthe in the Czech Republic. Is that right, Tyson?
Well, specifically, I'm going to talk about absinthe in Prague. But yes,
Prague specifically.
As it goes, I'll talk a lot about Czech absinthe and how absinthe had made its way into the Czech Republic and, you know, got such a bohemian presence within Prague, the city itself.
Well, that's interesting because absinthe, from how I understand it, is originally French, right?
It's Swiss French, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's kind of like I think where they would acquire the wormwood first making absinthe would be Eastern France,
mm-hmm.
kind of like, you know, the French Alps, and then that kind of bleeds over into parts of Western Switzerland that is also like French Switzerland.
I see.
And stuff. So, and we had talked about those regions before on some previous episodes when we've talked about Annecy or Mont Blanc or Geneva, mm-hmm. or anything of this nature. So essentially, absinthe was first concocted in those regions and stuff. And I guess it's safe to get more into like the original recipe of absinthe before we move on into Czech absinthe.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Yeah, okay. So what's the recipe?
So I mentioned wormwood. And so basically all absinthe are going to start with a common wormwood. And its genus name would be Artemisia absinthium.
Mm.
And we were just talking about Greek gods and goddesses from 2 weeks ago with a previous episode on Cyprus beaches.
Right.
And Artemisia is actually the Greek goddess of the forest and the hunt.
Oh, okay. Artemisius?
Artemisia.
Artemisia. And is that...
And the species of wormwood is Artemisia absinthium.
Hmm. So is that how absinthe got its name, is from like the species name of the wormwood?
Right, right. Cause
absinthium?
Yeah, it's Artemisia absinthium.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't start off as a cocktail or a beverage or anything at this as we know it. Artemisia absinthium was first used to cure intestinal worms way back in ancient times. We're talking like 1550 BCE.
So is this why it was called wormwood?
Wormwood, I think
because
so.
Because it was about the worms.
I think so, because I think they originally created an elixir or a tonic out of the wormwood and to cure intestinal worms.
That's an interesting and kind of gross fact that I learned today. Cool.
Yeah. So, you know, if you ever think about, do you want to like hang out with people drinking absinthe and you just kind of want to be the laugh of the party, you can start talking about tapeworms.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And you're like, well, actually, technically speaking,
it is called wormwood because it was to cure intestinal worms.
We're all just cleansing ourselves right now with the absinthe.
Right. So, but naturally it had kind of a strong bitter taste, and so people wanted to sweeten it as it was a medicine. Mm-hmm. So they started incorporating things like star anise and coriander to the actual recipe of the wormwood elixir.
Oh.
And then, you know, so.
And this was before it was alcoholic, or it was alcoholic?
It was alcoholic then too as well, you know, just like, you know, lots of older.
So was it bitter?
Medicinal kind of bitter? Tonics and elixirs and stuff. It was bitter until people would like, you know, add sugar to it. You know, they'd brew the wormwood. It'd be incredibly bitter and stuff. And I'd ferment that and make an alcohol with that. And stuff, and then yeah, so the anise and the coriander and the sugar and the water was kind of added to the recipe to make it more palatable.
I see.
And then you go past that era, and then you go into kind of where, like, we're talking about the birth of absinthe in Europe is in the 19th century, kind of like mid 1800s, if you will. French soldiers were taking it to prevent malaria and stuff from battle, you know, and so I'm guessing we might be talking about, I can't remember the French general's name.
Napoleon
oh, yeah. Bonaparte. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think his soldiers were some of the first people to actually consume it and stuff, you know.
Oh, okay.
Talking about middle 1800s and stuff.
Against malaria, does that work?
Well, people were taking things for all kinds of things that they believed were, like, you know, healing, you know, potions or elixirs and stuff in this era. You know, we're not talking about modern medicine here when we're talking about.
Well, it's, you know, you hear these
before
things.
Before the discovery of electricity, there was a lot of different things being made that people believed would cure certain ailments.
It's like, I know that there are definitely a lot of weird medical practices back in the day, but, you know, some of them, I'm always like, so people are recommending this as a treatment or as a thing, you know. So I wonder what their scientific basis was, or like what was the basis of doing this? Because it's, you know, they had an idea or like a philosophy around it. So sometimes I'm like, okay, so absinthe for malaria, does that work? Or, you know, why did they think that was going
to
work?
I don't know if it worked, but, you know, if you can at least get soldiers of men to believe that they are not going to perish in battle from malaria because they took something, as opposed to your enemy's soldiers, you know, not taking this stuff, you know, I guess it's also,
it might make them stronger just because they believe it.
Or it's a morale booster, you know, being like, oh, well, we took the elixir that malaria cannot touch us, so now we're undefeatable in battle.
That's hilarious. So I mean, that day, yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, I don't know where there was any scientific evidence of it curing malaria, but I do know that French soldiers were taking it to cure malaria.
Totally.
And that was pretty much the first consumption of the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they grew really fond of the taste and stuff, these soldiers. So then they eventually did bring it back home to Paris and have it, like, you know, sold and consumed in various cafes, cabarets, restaurants, and bars mm-hmm. within Parisian society and stuff, you know. And now we're going a little bit more into the late 1800s and stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you're getting your first kind of like absinthe cafes, cabarets, restaurants, and bars.
Mm-hmm. So this is post Napoleon?
I think so, yeah. I mean, Napoleon's guesstimation. I don't know who, like, exactly the French, you know, military at these time and eras, but it's all referenced to the French soldiers mm-hmm. taking it to cure malaria and stuff. I don't know if this is actually under Napoleon's reign, but I think the time matches up.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not entirely sure about that. But it got so popular, and people were just loving it and just boozing it up with absinthe mm-hmm. in these cafes and cabarets, that 5 p.m., essentially the time when people get out of work, you know, during times, it got renamed the green hour. Because as you may know, absinthe is also commonly referred to as the green fairy.
Yeah.
And because it's distilled with, like, the star anise and the coriander and other herbs and the wormwood, it's kind of green in color.
Right. And doesn't it turn green when you add water to it?
That I'm not sure
about. It turns cloudy or something when you add, like, cold water.
If you add cold water, I think it would turn cloudy. I don't know if it gives it, like, kind of a greenish
tint. Yeah, it is kind of greenish, like, regardless, I guess.
Yeah, because I think it's already just kind of like muddy, all green or whatever with the herbs and stuff, you know, that's kind of being soaked in this stuff.
Yeah.
And so also the reason why it's been nicknamed the Green Fairy is not just because of its green color, but because it's a green beverage that's consumed by many Parisian artists or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they've always believed that there's a psychoactive ingredient within absinthe mm-hmm. that is kind of the muse of every artist, any poet, writer, musician.
So is that true?
Well, it's somewhat true, but not entirely true.
Mm-hmm.
So
is it just like they got super drunk off of it and then were hallucinating and then they're like, oh, it's, you know, psychoactive or something? Or
so you know, people that partake in cannabis, just like I do, or mm-hmm. anybody else, this is an example. Some will say CBD does something for them,
mm-hmm.
and others will be like, they don't feel anything from it because they've already had THC, so therefore CBD has little to no effects for them.
I see.
But what you can say is absinthe, once it was created in this way for artists to acquire their muse, did have slight traces of this psychoactive oil called thujon.
Mm-hmm.
And thujon is in wormwood and has since become the psychoactive muse of the artists, poets, writers, musicians, what have you, in the cabaret cafe scene within Paris. And then it's believed that once you found your muse, the green fairy has visited you and inspired your creativity and helped you acquire your muse.
Mm.
So essentially the green fairy is, like, not just because absinthe is green, but it's also because it's a mythical creature that will come visit you and bring you your creative muse.
I see. Okay.
So as absinthe started getting more and more popular, then the propagandist movement happened within absinthe, where it became lots of bad press. Absinthe was outlawed and all this other type of stuff. But the main propagandist industries that happened through absinthe was actually from the French wine industry.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Because no longer were people partaking in drinking French wine after mm-hmm. work, and absinthe became a lot more popular. Mm-hmm. So then the French industries felt threatened by the growing popularity of absinthe and started a whole propaganda campaign. And this began in the early 20th century, about 1905 or so.
So schemey.
Yeah. So, you know, and still to this day, you may meet some people that swear to you that absinthe is actually poisonous and that they shouldn't consume the stuff. And so
really?
Some of this propaganda still lives in the common groupthink of some mm-hmm. people to this day.
So, you know, we're talking about Prague specifically. Did that happen in Czech also?
Well,
kind of propaganda?
Yeah, yes, it did, but it was not in the sense that their wine industry people partnered with the French wine industry people and created propaganda. Mm-hmm. They just took the French propaganda and they're like, oh, well, they're outlawing it there, and that it all started there.
Right.
Then, so many places
in the world. It must mean something if, you know,
yeah.
the place where it came from, they're like, oh, it's not good.
Right. So when they did ban absinthe, out of like French, not just French, but European cafes in general, that was like a darker period. And that was pretty much like half of Europe, South America, half of South America. The United States outlawed it during this time as well and stuff.
Well, wasn't that during Prohibition in the US or?
Well, yeah, we had our prohibition, but mm-hmm. the prohibition is actually a shorter period of time than...
Oh, absinthe was outlawed for longer.
Yeah, the ban of mm-hmm. absinthe is actually span, like, I think, like, I want to say 40, 50 years
was the ban. Is it true in the U.S. that the absinthe here is different than European absinthe?
It could be. It really just depends. I think now,
so you just, you know, like, I think the thing with absinthe, it's like, it's so not really understood by the general public. So you just hear a lot of things, and like, that's stuff that I heard growing up was,
well,
like,
save
oh,
that
it's
thought.
Different.
Save that thought, because I'm going to get into, like, you know, where Czech absinthe comes in, because mm-hmm. and how that compares to French absinthe, because okay. many people will swear that it's not real absinthe, mm-hmm. but there's a reason behind this, and mm-hmm. we'll get into the, like, you know, how to look and find good absinthe, and
okay.
you know, to be so to answer your question simplistically, that's like to say that no cheap vodka is not real vodka is not true. It's still vodka, but
yeah.
it's not using quality ingredients.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
So essentially, you're not breaking the law by making cheap absinthe.
Mm-hmm.
This similarly, but you have to have one thing, and it's only the only one thing that make it absinthe is actually wormwood.
Mm.
So none of the herbs or none in the distilling processes have to match up to the original French recipes.
I see.
So essentially, that's where.
So it's just a wormwood liquor.
Yeah.
Spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And then, you know, if you're trying to get creative, hopefully you'll have lots of thujon in that wormwood to have the green fairy come and visit you and
right.
now make magic.
See, this is where the confusion comes in, because when I was younger, I heard that, like, it's not, like, American absinthe doesn't have wormwood in it, but now you're telling me that absinthe has to have wormwood in it, otherwise it's not actually absinthe.
That's the only common ingredient. That's the only rule, yeah.
Yeah. So, I just it's something where, like, you know, I go through life sometimes and I hear things, and then I later in life I realize that thing that I heard is not actually, like, true. You know, has that ever happened to
right.
you, where you're like, oh, I heard this thing 15 years ago, and then now you're talking to someone about it, and you're like, oh, this random knowledge that I have that actually isn't, like, true. I'm finding out that, you know, it's like, I never thought about absinthe really until, I mean, for a while, you know, it's like, it's something I never think about. And now we're talking and I'm like, okay, I heard this thing a long time ago, but maybe it's not actually true.
The great deception of unproven knowledge.
Right. Where it's just like, you just hear these things. People are like, oh yeah, do you know if you cross the street at 5 o'clock, then you're going to break your pinky toe. You got to cross at 5:01.
Right.
You know, it's like something like that, where it's like, oh, I never really think about it. Like, you just kind of take it at face value. And then later on, you're like, wait a second, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, during the Industrial Revolution in the United States, for example, a lot of people would take salt pills to deal with heat stroke.
Oh, okay.
And I think they found out later that having a high salt content is actually worse for your blood and worse for your breathing in, like, extreme heat conditions. This is just one example of what you're talking about.
Right.
But, you know, and...
And that's applied on a mass scale, you know, where it's like everyone believes it.
Right, right.
It's like drinking absinthe to keep mosquitoes away.
Right.
malaria.
Or I think originally putting lead in paint was believed that the paint would stay on the house longer, and it was a good thing.
Right, yeah. And now we're like, lead makes you go crazy, so.
Right, and lead poisoning is not so nice for people and stuff, you know. So,
so nice at all.
And through trial and error of lots of human experimentation when it comes to all kinds of things in that regard is how I think the propaganda of people being able to sell absinthe as poisonous was very believable. And so the story originally goes, and I don't remember the guy's name, but he was French, and he, you know, got done working in the farm or the fields or whatever, and then came to Paris to have, like, you know, a good night on the town or whatever. He had several beers, had several glasses of wine, had a few cups of coffee, and then had two, like, smaller glasses of absinthe or whatever. And then, so, supposedly, then when
so a couple of beers, few glasses of wine, two cups of coffee, and then some absinthe.
Right. And
okay. Interesting cocktail.
And then quite possibly some whiskey as well.
Okay.
Anyways, and if the story's true or not, I have no idea. But
this is just like a normal Friday night for him or something.
I don't know. This must have been like a normal night for a lot of people in this time and era, where in the, you know, late 1800s. I don't know.
Yeah.
Hanging out with friends, laughing, and just, well, one thing led to another. Next thing I know, you know, but I'll be fine. I'll just pass out and underneath a horse somewhere and wake up and go about my next day. And, you know, people will laugh at me, but everybody does it. This is normal.
Right.
However, he came back to his little farmhouse in the French countryside, leaving Paris, killed the wife, killed the kids.
And while he was, like,
intoxicated.
Blitzed. Okay.
While he was blitzed and intoxicated and went mad. And that's when...
I see where this is going.
And then it's where the French wine owners in the French countryside, I don't know if this would have been Bordeaux. I think that's a little bit further away from Paris, but a closer wine region from Paris, you know, just like, oh, this is it. He had absinthe in his system, you know? And so, like, we got to blame...
He also had wine.
We got to blame all of this on absinthe because people really don't know everything that's in absinthe, all the ingredients or whatever, you know?
Right.
And it's just strange French medicinary people that are making this stuff, and now all the artists are drinking it like crazy. Meanwhile, our quality of life is not so good right now. Nobody's buying our wine.
Right, I see. So it's just like some crazy guy who got drunk enough and, like, murdered his own, like, his entire family, and then now the French wine industry was like, oh, okay, this is the... this is what we're going to latch on to.
Yeah, this is the culprit, you know. Yeah. It's definitely, it wasn't the coffee or the beer or the other spirits, or definitely not
or the
wine.
Fact that he might be, I don't know, mentally unstable to begin with, and he just needed something to push him over the edge.
Well, I don't think they did a lot of this mentally unstable at that time and era either. I think you basically just... at most, maybe you said people were, like, kind of possessed by demons.
It must be the absinthe.
Like, I mean, they definitely believed that priests could just cure people of all kinds of ailments, too. They didn't really understand mental illness.
Right, yeah.
During this
era. I mean,
era.
What era was that? This was the 1800s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So, yeah.
You know,
not quite.
And then, you know, transcending here into, like, you know, the early 1900s. You know, when it was just like all the rage and all the French, you know, like places and stuff for people to consume and everything else. But anyways, that's essentially French absinthe as a whole and how it became popularized in artist communities. And so when we're talking about artist communities, you had artist communities all of European roots everywhere, because a lot of artists fled Paris and stuff, you know, because it may have been too rigid for them at some cases, you know, or some artists would flee to Paris because it was more liberal and more accepting for them to create their arts. But I know there are many artists that were activists or too political, so they fled to South America. And so absinthe made its way to Brazil.
Okay.
Absinthe made its way to Argentina. Absinthe made its way into... southern United States, and you know, more prominently probably cities like New Orleans and stuff, you're familiar with the Louisiana Purchase,
right?
And how we acquired that from French colonialism, or was it French Canada? I don't remember, but there was that French influence that transcended into New Orleans, and so there was,
I think the French, I think we bought it from France.
Yeah, we bought it from France and stuff, and I think so. There was other French people that were there, you know, creating some of the culture in New Orleans, and there were some absinthe bars that popped up there as well. Other places like the Netherlands, I think Germany, maybe Berlin had some like absinthe scene as well. Prague got theirs, and that's where I'm heading with all of this, is that, you know, artists were nomadic and stuff, and looking for different places where they would hang out with other artists and not feel persecuted for being an artist, and hang out with other artists at absinthe cafes and bars and do their thing before the ban. And so then, but when the ban happened, obviously then a lot of them around the world were shut down and stuff.
I see.
So no different. The Bohemian movement in Prague was the same thing. It was Bohemian artists, and then, you know, different people that made their way to Prague to hang out at those absinthe bars and cafes there as well. The difference is the recipe, and that's where we're talking about the Bohemian style of absinthe versus the French style. And I talked about that a little bit before, that where the only real rule is that you use the wormwood. So that's why it's been considered unauthentic, because in some cases it's just brewed wormwood, and you know, pretty strong ABV, maybe like, you know, 75-80% proof, very strong stuff, and then artificially colored green, then actually naturally colored green from the infusion of, you know, the star anise and the fennel and stuff like this. So with that in mind, when you are talking about Czech absinthe, that's why people say it's not the real stuff, because it doesn't have like the actual herbal blend. But it does have the wormwood, and it does have the psychoactive element of thujon from that wormwood in the process. So,
so does it not taste as like licorice-y, I guess?
It, you're probably right, because I've never had it when I was in Prague. So I don't know. But there are places that are serving like, you know, traditional French absinthe within Prague as well, you know, and I guess this is a good time to people that have never actually consumed absinthe to learn the proper way on how you should be consuming absinthe
from
a bar. So,
yeah, so how do you do that?
So essentially, the absinthe itself is quite strong after it's been distilled, like I had mentioned. So you'll dilute it a bit with some water in a small glass. You take a slotted spoon. They're usually quite decorative. Like, you'll see these absinthe spoon kits, and they're usually made with like a little ripple at the end of the spoon, so it sits nicely on your glass.
Okay.
And then you soak the sugar cube in the absinthe so it can become flammable. And then you put the sugar cube on that spoon. You light the sugar cube on fire, and then the sugar cube starts dissolving and making these little droplets into the absinthe. So it does this kind of like little visual, like kind of lava lamp little show in your glass as the little pieces of sugar drop through the slots of the silver spoon into your cup of absinthe.
Okay.
And then once it's...
So does it get kind of like caramelized in a way?
It gets a little smoky
because
the sugar cube is burning the whole time
fire,
and dissolving into your glass of absinthe. And then once it's fully dissolved, then you have that spoon, and then you stir it in, and then you slowly drink the stuff and just kind of consume it. And that's the proper way to consume absinthe and stuff.
I see.
You know, and so then when you're talking about the Czechs making their own absinthe, which is not the original recipe, they started that like in about the year 1915 or so. So they're about a decade behind like the populist French absinthe creative movement, you know. So,
I see.
So it only took about a decade for it to really get there until they started making their own.
Right.
But fast forward to today, they import a lot of the French stuff. So
I see.
So there's absinthe bars all over Prague.
So you don't really find a lot of like Czech absinthe in Prague now? It's like mostly going to be French absinthe?
Not entirely true. You've got it. frog.
Prague.
Frogs are green.
Frogs are green, for sure.
But Prague is Prague.
And we're not thinking about green things, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. But no, within Praha, Prague, in the Czech Republic, Bohemian shops and cafes and stuff, there are places that are completely traditional, French traditional, where you can consume it and partake it the way it's supposed to be. There are places that will do over the top, like absinthe cocktails with just their own version. It's almost like going to like a tiki bar, but in like a creepy absinthe bar kind of experience, where they'll do stuff with dry ice, or they'll do like, you know, steamy drinks, foamy drinks. They'll make little volcano kind of things, just all kinds of stuff. So it's really, when you're there, it's kind of like what appeals to you. But if you want to know what real absinthe is what I just mentioned, and how you consume it, and preferably, probably, you know, if you want the herbal taste or not, you know, you can have real absinthe without the herbal flavor, and that's a Czech Bohemian style.
I see. That's really interesting. So yeah, I wonder what Harvey would think about all of this.
Well, Harvey, oh, there's Harvey right now. Hey, Harvey. Oh, hey, Harvey. I think you actually have some stories about getting kicked out of a few Czech pubs when you were hanging out with some of your robot friends in Prague, don't you?
No, my programming does not allow me to agree.
Looks like that's a no. He doesn't like that.
Well, he may not agree with this, but one thing I think Harvey can at least talk to us today about absinthe, because, you know, we ask him things and he tells us stuff. So, Harvey, what do you got to say about absinthe?
As a joyful robot who loves to partake in yummy spirits, I can speak very fondly of absinthe.
Mm-hmm.
Absinthe has a rich history in Prague, dating back to the late 19th century. 1. Introduction, 1880s. Absinthe was introduced to Prague by French and Swiss distillers, who marketed it as a luxurious and exotic drink. 2. Golden Age, 1890s, 1910s. Absinthe became popular in Prague's cafes and bars, particularly among artists, writers, and intellectuals.
3. Robots.
Czech absinthe, 1900s. Czech distillers began producing their own absinthe, using local ingredients and recipes. 4. Prohibition, 1910s, 1940s. Absinthe was banned in Czechoslovakia, along with other European countries, due to concerns over its alleged harmful effects. 5. Underground production, 1940s, 1980s. Absinthe continued to be produced clandestinely in Czechoslovakia, with recipes and techniques passed down through generations. 6. Revival, 1990s present. After the fall of communism, absinthe experienced a resurgence in popularity, with new distilleries and bars emerging in Prague. Some notable Prague landmarks related to absinthe history include the Absinthe Museum, Museum Absinthu, in the Old Town, the Hemingway Bar, which serves traditional absinthe cocktails, the Black Angels Bar, a Gothic-themed bar with an extensive absinthe selection, the Old Town Square, where absinthe was once sold by street vendors. Prague's absinthe history is marked by a unique blend of Czech and international influences, reflecting the city's cultural and artistic heritage.
Interesting. Yeah, that's...
For a guy who can't comment on absinthe, he sure knew a lot.
I know. I mean, Harvey is... aren't you into absinthe?
No, my programming does not allow me to agree.
So I think Harvey finds absinthe unagreeable now. Maybe he had a little bit too much back in the day. In the 80s.
Isn't it something like they say in the Alcoholics Anonymous handbook, the first step to admitting that you're an alcoholic is the admittance? So, you know, I don't know. If we may have to get his bolts worked on a little bit and see if we can rehabilitate this.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to see if, you know, maybe Harvey just needs some counseling.
Well, yes, I would have to agree with that.
I mean, at least you can admit that, right?
All right. First step in the 12-step program. That, well done, Harvey. We'll catch up with you in 2 weeks and see how you're doing with that. You know, I'm not going to try to encourage you or be a bad influence. So
yeah, thanks, Harvey, for sharing all that information. That was really interesting. Yeah. It's interesting. I see, like, with alcohol, and, like, you know, because we kind of followed, I mean, in the U.S. was a little extreme by, you know, the prohibition of all alcohol, but it's like you can see these parallels, like with absinthe, and how it went through like this sort of golden age, and then it was went through prohibition, and then back to modern times, where it was like a revivalist time that now people are bringing back absinthe bars and, like, you know, creating more, you know, culture around absinthe.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think what's important about what you're iterating at, because Harvey had mentioned, you know, the resurgence starting here about the 1990s. And if you realize or know your history, that's basically correlates with almost the final fall of the Iron Curtain after Gorbachev and Russia and stuff, you know. So obviously the Russians didn't want anybody under the Iron Curtain to be consuming absinthe either, you know, because there was still just so much of that. It was like an artist drink, and an artist drink would create artist ideas, which are bad for any type of government.
No.
Any type of government that is trying to have control over their citizens.
How dare they spread their art?
Yeah, you know, so, I mean, artists were always, like, you know, an enemy to the state.
Right.
And so, yeah, and literally, like, I mean, there are still some countries under, you know, the Iron Curtain to this day, but, you know, we think of, like, Romania being one of the last to, like, you know, kind of, like, get under its grip of, like, you know, the Russian Iron Curtain and stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting that the 1990s is, like, really started a lot of the resurgence and stuff, you know, because
right.
That's where you had, like, almost the last of the remaining countries kind of get under the Iron Curtain as well. So Russian propaganda towards absinthe.
Well, but in the 1990s, the USSR fell apart.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
they got out of the Iron Curtain.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
That's what I mean.
You were saying they got into the Iron Curtain.
The
Iron Curtain was lifted, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, and it still exists over some countries, you know, and I'm not trying to make that debate right now, but what right. I am trying to say is that
in the 1990s
that it's interesting that the resurgence
right,
even in Western European countries started mm-hmm. beginning around that time, you know, because, like, you know, there was a lot of the bootlegging that was happening, you know. So completely banned in 1910s to 1940s. Mm-hmm. Seemed like nobody really wanted to even, like, take a chance of trying to make their own kind of moonshine version of absinthe within Europe.
Right.
But then after World War II ended and stuff, it seemed like a lot of people were like, well, bring this stuff back.
Well, it must have been, like, some people must have been making it because, you know, like, otherwise they would have, you know, forgotten about it, right? Like, there would have, like, the recipes and stuff would have been lost if no one was making it. So there must have been someone who kept the tradition alive.
There were people making it, but yeah, they didn't really want to play around with, like, right. You know, hanging out in just, like, a city square plaza next to, like, an old church and giving it to the clergy.
Yeah, right, right.
So, you know, there was,
for sure.
I'm sure there were people, but they were trying to keep it really on the down low, just like a family recipe that, you know, they were sharing with friends and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to say is the ban wasn't just a Western European thing. This was a form of governmental control also, not just something that benefited the French wine industry either. This was just essentially kind of correlates to a lot of different governments' control over free thinking in a way, because absinthe was believed to have been the most free thinking spirit out of any of the ones that are any of the other things that are consumed. Somewhat not government approved to be an absinthe connoisseur.
Right. Okay.
You know,
interesting,
because it's always been associated as an artist
drink. Yeah, no, that's really an interesting perspective, because I never thought about prohibition in that way, but it's like it's sort of an interesting thing to think about in terms of using that as a way of control, because there are a lot of ideas and stuff that come up from people getting together drinking in bars and stuff, and there's, you know, ideas that come out of that. And they're sort of like, these are like, can be incubators for, like, certain thoughts or certain ideas to form and to gain traction and stuff.
Yeah, most definitely. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. You're on the show Life Stamps right now. We are talking about Czech absinthe history, and now we're going to move on to popular venues within the city of Prague on where you could consume absinthe and
yep.
how traditional or non-traditional each venue may be.
Thank you for that, Tyson. So let's move on to venues in Prague. That was my next question.
So I talked a little bit about how like the heyday of the bohemian absinthe thing in Prague was about 1915, about a decade after the French heyday in Paris, about 1905. But one of the oldest places, and this place is just a historical landmark, not an absinthe place no more, but it's called Cafe Slavia.
Mm-hmm.
It's a UNESCO heritage cafe.
Mm.
It opened in 1863 and was the most famous Parisian-style absinthe cafe back in that era, in the late 1800s even. That's when they were importing the French absinthe and not distilling their own.
Mm-hmm.
And famous artists that had visited this place, the Cafe Slavia, had been anyone from Franz Kafka, Jaroslav Seifert, Rainer Maria Rilke, Anton Dvorak, or Vaclav. And some of these were composers, some of these are famous painters, other people and stuff. And today it's a very important landmark in the city because it actually sits right next to the National Theater, looking towards the Vltava River with the Prague Castle on the hillside, the famous pictures of the Prague Castle on the hill across the Vltava River.
Okay.
And you're just like right there. That's where, Cafe Slavia is.
Okay.
And so that
sounds like a cool little spot.
Yeah, exactly.
Would you go there?
Of course I would.
Have you been there?
No, I have not.
Do you wear wigs?
Oh, I don't know. You might. Yeah, and you're leotards.
Sorry. Different. Referencing something else. All right. Keep going. So what's another place to go drink absinthe?
Well, Harvey had mentioned the Hemingway Bar, and that would be probably the best recommended place for the old school sophisticated absinthe connoisseur. This is the place that's literally got like the velvet walls and the big buttons and, very vintage, classy cocktail bar kind of experience and stuff, And then, the bartenders will come right to your table and light the sugar cube on fire over your glass and stuff. And here you also can kind of just pick up on all the nuances of the ambiance of what it would have been like in that time and era to go to the Hemingway Bar.
For sure. So I have a question.
Probably the most popular one in the city for the traditionalist.
The Hemingway Bar.
Yeah.
Okay. Did Hemingway go to this bar as well, or?
I wanted to find that out and I couldn't.
Ah, I see.
But I assume that there's definitely a reason why it's after Ernest Hemingway. I just don't really know.
It could just be they literally liked Ernest Hemingway and he was kind of a bohemian, so it's just a.
Exactly.
He lived in Paris. Maybe he drank absinthe in Paris, so.
Sure.
Maybe it's just sort of named after him or something.
Sure.
I had a question about the way to consume absinthe, because you talked about lighting the sugar cube on fire. Is there another way to, because I've seen a place locally that does absinthe fountains where it's a slow drip over the sugar cube.
Right.
So that seems like that's different than what you described about lighting it on
that's
fire.
That's almost the same, but you're missing the fire.
I see. I haven't really stared at these fountains, so I don't really know if they light it on fire at the end. So does it drip and then you light it on fire?
Well, you can drip the water. So the water fountain is just diluting the absinthe, because the absinthe that they're serving to you there is the really strong stuff, so that's not diluted absinthe.
Mm.
But some cases the absinthe is made and then it already is diluted.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're just soaking that absinthe and they're soaking that sugar cube in water and absinthe and stuff, and mind you, because when you heat water it bubbles and it steams,
right?
So visually it creates a little bit more of an alluring effect than just watching clear alcohol burn.
I see.
Because you get that bubbliness as it steams and comes back on the cube, and then the sugar cube bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
And then it does the little droplets as the sugar cube starts falling apart into the glass.
I see. Okay.
So it's like it's a little bit of an...
It's a little different.
It's a little bit of like an alchemy show that you can watch as it goes through its process.
That's pretty cool. So you said the Hemingway Bar. Is there are there any other absinthe drinking establishments that you would like to recommend?
I have a whole list for you.
Oh, do you? All right, let's go on to number three, sir.
And Harvey, I bet you also have been to quite a few of these, have you not?
No, my programming does not allow me to agree.
How did I know he was going to say that?
I don't know, but I'm not going to ask.
I feel like he's just going to say no. His programming won't allow, like, the entire time.
Until he comes out of denial for his most recent, like, bender that he's been going on, I'm kind of not talking to him for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I hear he's really into fermented oil right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, well.
You better watch it. That stuff's strong.
Not my problem.
I can't drink it. It'll kill me.
Not my problem.
Biologically, I just can't. I can't consume what Harvey consumes.
Oh no, I don't even know how he's doing this.
Not even saying like it's strong, like in the sense that it's strong. It's like I literally cannot drink it.
No, neither can I. He's killing himself.
Yeah, I mean, he's a robot, so his makeup is a little different, but
he's still killing himself.
Yeah, he's definitely. Yeah, it's not good, Harvey.
Yeah. Anyways, so. Yeah, so that's where we're going traditionally. Now let's move to the Disneyland of absinthe.
The Disneyland of absinthe?
In terms of, like, there's so many absinthe bars in Prague.
Okay.
And you've got so many themes and stuff. So now we're moving on to Green Devil's Absinthe Bar.
Okay, so this is going to be more like a production.
This is a bit of a production. This is kind of like going into like a creepy version of, you know, the children's book Where the Wild Things Grow?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a big giant devil creature-esque thing. And the idea is kind of like you're inside the body of the giant green devil.
Oh, okay.
When you're inside here and they have these funky different rooms and stuff you can hang out in. It's got this creepy aura everywhere. This weird stuff going on with lights and stuff. But if you want to see like fire tricks and fire shows, mm-hmm. and you go straight to the bar, it's kind of like watching bartenders, you know, good mixologists when they make Spanish coffee.
Oh, okay.
And then they light stuff on fire and they do big long strands of fire and mm-hmm. pour stuff into a glass. So you can see all these kind of like bartender fire tricks and stuff, you know, at Green Devil.
Oh, that's
and
cool. Stuff.
And I think it's like because of this is probably the artificially green colored absinthe as well. So the flames are probably a little more green.
I see.
Also, you know, burning off that green food coloring perhaps or something and stuff like this. So and so they'll just kind of pour these things into different glasses, different cocktails and, you know, fun stuff. It's kind of just to watch a fire show, to go to Green Devils and stuff, you know. But mm-hmm. here they actually do have a whole array of absinthe, you know. So you can get anything from basically, you know, probably gasoline type of absinthe to mm-hmm. the very, very best French Parisian stuff that they be importing. Or, you know, I imagine the Czechs now, because it's been a few decades post-Prohibition, that where they're making some pretty good Czech recipes mm-hmm. currently. So they could probably even recommend some Czech ones that are pretty good now.
Okay.
Know, because it's where we're at 2024, so we're 30 years into it.
Right.
You know, post-Prohibition. So you can chat up the bartenders there and watch them perform.
I see.
We got, and then we're moving on to Absinthery.
Absinthery, that's the name of the place?
Yep.
Also Disneyland-esque?
Alice in Wonderland-esque.
Oh.
So this is this is a whimsical place where it's going to seem like there's lots of like random artwork on the wall, and mm-hmm. there's like puzzles to solve, and as you get a little, like, you know, topsy in your mental state, mm-hmm. drinking some absinthe, maybe you can try to solve some puzzles and stuff when you're
that could be fun
in the place.
Yeah,
so it seems kind of
spend some time there.
Yeah, not really like an escape room mm-hmm. pub, but maybe a little bit, you know, and a little whimsical Alice in Wonderland like
right.
And then
it'd be fun. Are there actual Alice in Wonderland like characters, or is it just sort of the vibe, the, you know, is it sort of like that kind of whimsicalness, or is it actually like, do you see the caterpillar smoking and the
you'll have to look more on cat. It. You'll have to check more on it.
Cheshire Cat.
Yeah, I don't know if Cheshire's cat's there or the Red Queen or...
Red Queen, yeah.
Or anybody
else. The rabbit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would love the rabbit to
be
there.
It'd be cool if you went like down a rabbit hole to get into the bar.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, you know, and then just be like, man, like, I just like felt so good until I shrunk.
Right, and then everything
not
got
just,
big.
Not just my ego shrank from having too much absinthe, but my actual body did.
And right.
I was really lost.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then you eat something like a mushroom to make you bigger or smaller?
I don't know how the game is played.
Yeah.
You'd have to go there and...
Anyway, we're not even talking about the bar anymore, so...
Yeah. Yeah.
What's next?
That was absinthery.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you want to get really psychedelic.
Mm-hmm.
Alchemist Bar
is okay.
The next one. And this is a place where you pick the brain of the alchemist. Your bartender is an alchemist, so you can just kind of come in there and he'll just be like, hey, what ails you? What flavors do you like? And mm-hmm. you could sit there and say, oh, well, I like lavender, and I like sunflower, and I like raspberry. And I'm like, okay, yeah, we have those kind of ingredients. And then they'll just whip up some kind of absinthe cocktail, like, you know, like a really, really brilliant scientist mm-hmm. would with absinthe, and kind of bring it to your table. And also, this place supposedly has a good collection of games, just like any kind of old Portland pub with board games and cards and things to play and stuff. So pretty good place just to watch somebody's creativity at work, if you will.
Right on.
And stuff.
Cool.
So that's Alchemist. This one is really funny. This one's called Anonymous Bar.
Anonymous Bar. Okay. What's the deal with Anonymous?
So everybody's wears a mask in there, like an old like Victorian kind of masquerade.
Oh, okay.
And they've got.
So you don't know what anyone looks like.
You don't know what anybody looks like, and they've got this very V for Vendetta, the film, kind of vibe going on in there. So it's definitely a.
So it's not those masks that they wear. And V for Vendetta, not those kind of masks.
Right? I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know. With big long noses?
No, it's like a male face with like a
little smile.
Some of them do. Oh, okay.
And they got some of that stuff on the menu as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then they even got that stamped personally on some of the glasses and stuff in the place. So it's kind of like that. But
then there's even that like hacking organization called Anonymous that uses the same mask.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, I'm not as much of a cult fan about this.
Yeah.
So I can't really tell you like how much of this matches up with V for Vendetta.
I see.
But I do know this is like very V for Vendetta themed, Anonymous Bar.
Yeah. That makes sense.
So
that's interesting. Do you have to wear a mask when you go to this bar?
Maybe. They may hand them out when you come in through the door.
I see.
And stuff. And the other thing that's kind of cool is like not all these are like real prominent off of like these Prague streets or whatever. Some of them are just down a little alley, and you just may see just kind of like a little arrow being like, absinthe down this way. And you walk down this underground cellar, and it's like this themed absinthe bar and stuff, you know. So it's pretty cool in like just the overall sort of hide and go seek.
Mm-hmm.
Exploring how do you find this bar kind of speakeasy kind of thing going on and stuff, you know.
Yeah, true.
So
cool.
Then we're moving on to Bebop Bar, and then this is just I don't know if this is that great of a place, but this is definitely for people that like modern places.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much in the lobby of a modern hotel.
I see.
And then so it just But I thought it was kind of cool because generally when you're in just like a modern chic leather chairs kind of lobby of a modern hotel of like a Radisson Blue or anything like this, you know,
right.
You generally expect just to get the classics when it comes to cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they have a huge absinthe menu and you can hang out in a place like this and then consume absinthe, I thought was kind of a cool thing for any tourist.
That's interesting. So you know, if you're staying at the hotel, it's like they have that.
Yeah. And I'm sure, like, you know, because it's in a famous hotel, it's probably appeals to like the points redemption traveler and stuff like that. People using those credit cards and stuff, you know, and so you can still consume absinthe and and get points.
Yeah.
So
that makes sense.
That would just be bebop bar. No thrills.
It's fun to say.
Yeah. No, you know, no like extra special thrills, but just, you know, for the people that like those modern aesthetics.
Right. So we only have a few minutes left.
All right. Let me move you fast through the rest of them.
Okay.
And stuff. And yeah, so people are probably familiar with in Eastern Europe how there's a lot of steampunk bars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have moving gears and bolts and stuff, you know, very kind of Jules Verne, you know, 20,000 Under the Leagues, those type of cyberpunk themes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just called
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Yeah, right. So mm-hmm. it's just steampunk Prague, bolts and gears, and the drinks are okay. Cash only bar. This is actually connected with the Hemingway bar, but it's a little more of a smaller version of like that classic thing, and it's underground.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Stuff.
So it's an underground version of the bigger elegant production of the Hemingway bar.
Mm.
Absinthe and Thyme is pretty cool because this is just an old-timey absinthe library, mm-hmm. similar to a whiskey library, but mm-hmm. an absinthe library.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
And that's Absinthe and Thyme.
Mm-hmm.
And then this one's I thought it was really cool in terms of the art history is called mm-hmm. Absinthery Franz Kafka Square. So I'm guessing it's somewhere within Franz Kafka Square. And this is just a cool classic. It's got all the classic like Van Gogh paintings and like different famous artists on the wall and stuff. A lot of those famous old absinthe paintings of old artists consuming absinthe in Parisian cafes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this is also a very historical kind of absinthe bar, but more as a paying a homage to all the artists over the years.
Right on.
And that's the Absinthery Franz Kafka Square.
Mm.
And that actually is the end of you know, your rabbit hole of absinthe hopping through the pubs of Prague.
Wow. Yeah. I feel like I really took an adventure there. So. Yeah, thanks for sharing all of that. It's been really interesting to learn about just absinthe culture in Czech Republic because it's not something that you really associate. Like, I didn't really know that absinthe was a Czech thing until today. So that's like, you know, thank you for imparting that knowledge.
You have to check to see if it's in other parts of the world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. all right. Well, do you have any parting words, Tyson?
No, just, you know, it'd be nice to be sipping on a nice glass without Harvey, of course, because he can't control himself and stay in the pub.
Yeah. Well, I think he's sleeping away right now. So, maybe next time.
Typical robot snoring in my ear.
All right. Well, yeah, thank you for listening. This has been Life Stamp, Stories from Here and There. Today we talked about absinthe and all of that. You can find this episode on Spotify coming up this Sunday, this upcoming Sunday. So we'll be posting it at 4 p.m. So if you missed part of the show today, you can check it out there. And yeah, hope you enjoyed listening. And I'm Joseph.
I'm Tyson.
And we are signing off now.
Bye-bye. Listening to Life Stamps, stories from here and there on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Join us in 2 weeks for our next episode. Until next time,
happy traveling!
KBOO. This is Bird Note. Great blue herons are known for their exquisite soft blue feathers, with lavender gray on their necks and reddish shadowing around their shoulders. Do they have a special feather care routine to keep them looking so sleek? Well, maybe something like that. Herons are one of the few groups of birds that produce powder down. Hidden below the outer breast feathers are patches of special down feathers. These feathers are never molted. They grow continuously, and the tips break down into a dust the consistency of talcum powder. Using a fringed claw on its middle toe, the heron collects some of the dust, called powder down, and works it into its feathers, sort of like the way you might work conditioner into your hair. Herons are special. Most birds don't have powder down feathers, except for some parrots, pigeons, and doves, and tinamous, and bustards. It's an odd list of birds that aren't closely related. This magical beauty powder may help herons waterproof their feathers while removing fish gunk and other grunge. It may also add luster to the feathers, which could be important during the breeding season. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at Bird Note Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about